We talked to a lot of people actually in a very short amount of time because this thing kind of blew up. Screen Rant ran our story, and then IndieWire contacted us, and Movie Maker contacted us, and like it all, yeah, it was awesome. And so we got all this like free publicity for it, and like people were like hearing my name for the first time and like seeing a lot of Wanna organically through this NFT thing. And then this company, this NFT company, ended up not wanting to work with us because what we were doing was technically illegal, which we didn't know.
Welcome back to Cool Hand Crypto, where cinema, culture, and crypto collide. My name is Matt Silverman, and I'm a filmmaker. I suppose you could say I was always a filmmaker if we look back at some of the family videos of me torturing my little brother. But professionally speaking, I've worked in the industry in Los Angeles since 2007, until the pandemic brought LA and our sanity to its knees, and we packed up and left. But that's a story for another show. Industry-wise, I began fresh-faced at the bottom rung of the production hierarchy as a PA on films and TV shows, delivering coffees, dealing walkies, and changing toilet paper rolls, but with a keen eye on every player, every process, and every decision in an ever-changing landscape. From there, I produced directed music videos, collaborated with brands, influencers, agencies, produced a Travolta film, and everything in between. But at the end of the day, I just love cinema. I love storytelling, and the crown jewel of experience for me is directing. So today, it's a real pleasure to introduce a filmmaker who I've never met, but who's also been navigating this world in a parallel timeline at yet another inflection point in filmmaking. His talents have earned him an Emmy, Vimeo Staff Picks, the title Exceptional Filmmaker from National Geographic, and he is now about to introduce his feature directorial debut, Lotawana, all while navigating the bleeding edge of where cinema meets crypto. Trevor Hawkins, welcome to the show.
Hell yeah, man. Thanks for having me, Matt.
So I'm really excited to dig into your film and NFTs and a little bit of everything. So let's start with your background. When did you start making films and where are you coming from?
I grew up and still live at Lake Lotawanna, Missouri. And my friends, since we were puppies, pretty much were skateboarding and wakeboarding and all the extreme sports stuff. And then I picked up my mom's video camera and started filming it. And then as I got older, I became more and more obsessed with the film, like the extreme sports videos, like the filmmakers that would put out these awesomely creative videos like Spike Jones. And there's a couple of wakeboarding guys that I really look up to. And I just became more and more interested in the art of the cinema than the actual tricks themselves. We all still skate and everything. It's fun. But like, that's where it all started for me. And then I just became obsessed with filmmaking. And then in high school, I went over to my buddy's house, and in 1 week, we watched Requiem for a Dream, Donnie Darko, and A Clockwork Orange. And I'd never seen movies like that. And that's like watching that Trinity just like blew my mind. And I remember sitting in his basement just like in the dark after they're over with each one and being like, what did I just watch? Like, movies can do this. And then from then on, I just had a dream to make a movie. I'm a commercial filmmaker as well. I'm a director DP. And so I spend a lot of my time making my money that way. But I'd always had this dream of being in production of my first feature film by the time I turned 30. And I think I was in my late 20s, and I just looked at my wife and I was like, how long does it take to make a movie? Should we get started now? And then that's what happened with Lotawanna. We just self-funded the whole thing and used crew that we already knew and loved and a bunch of our friends. And it was just such a like a grassroots organic experience the whole way through it.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Before we get to Lotawanna, tell me more about working in Missouri. Is there a film community there? And what has been your experience as far as finding film type work there?
Really good, actually. Sometimes there's a good thing of being like a big fish in a small pond as opposed to, you know, like versus the other way around. And so we have a great community here in Kansas City. I live about 45 minutes outside of Kansas City, so I'm daily with all those guys. They're my production home. And I'm repped by a production company here, RW2 Studios in Kansas City. And so we've got a great film community here. I would say the pool isn't very deep, but the people that we have here all like seem like they get paid really well and are really talented. So I really like our little community here.
Have you ever thought about moving to LA or New York or anything like that? Like I said in the intro, I used to live in LA, but I'm in Boston now, which is where my family, you know, where I grew up and where my family is. And our future, my wife is in the industry also, but our future as far as where we're going to live is so uncertain. And filmmaking itself has become sort of more remote because of the pandemic. You don't need to be in LA. You don't need to be in New York or anywhere else. But have you thought about moving to other places, or there was just never a need?
Oh, yeah. I have definitely thought about it many times. And my wife has even pushed me once to do it. Since I've lived my whole life at Lake Lackawanna, Missouri, all of my friends are here. All of my family is here. Literally my entire life is here. And I have a kid here. And it's like filmmaking is my passion and everything I want to do professionally in my life and creatively. But I also have like a life outside of that. And I would have to abandon everything that I am and everyone that I know to go chase that dream. And at the end of the day, I know that I will be happier as a person if I stay here. And it's not without sacrifice. Like I said, the pool isn't very deep here. There's not a lot of opportunities here. Out in LA, there's a lot more people doing a lot bigger things, a lot cooler things than in Kansas City. And I know I'm missing out on a lot of opportunities just by not being able to rub shoulders with everybody. So there's a bit of a trade-off there. To me, I had to make the tough decision to stay. And I mean, it's nice because you can shoot anything you want in Kansas City. Like, you don't need permits to go out on the street. You can go to people's houses and everyone's like, oh my gosh, a movie.
Right,
and then
right.
They'll like open their doors and make you brownies and the whole bit. And like in LA, it's not like that.
No.
So there's also that benefit of being here, but we'll see long term if it was the right decision. But it feels like the right decision for me. And like, we made this super cheap indie film, Lackawanna, getting ready to release it out into the world on February 3rd. And we'll see. Hopefully that will bring a little bit of organic attention and make this whole Kansas City thing pay off.
Hell yeah. So let's dig into Lackawanna. Because I'm a filmmaker, I'm really fascinated with the process of other filmmakers and from start to finish. So
I know the feeling.
we might get a little granular here as far as all of the steps, but so let's start with sort of the writing process and the concept. How did that all begin?
When I decided to make a feature film, I'd always had this idea in my head of this movie that I've written a script to since then, but it was just too big. It was too much to tackle as a first indie film that we're financing ourselves. We literally got a loan against our house to pay for most of it. And I purposely sat down and thought about what we could film for free. You know, like I live on a lake and it's gorgeous here. And so that's pretty much a free asset that is. And since I grew up filming wakeboarding too, filming on the water is secondhand to me. Like, that's kind of where I started filming. And so I'm very comfortable shooting on the water and in boats and everything. And so I just thought of a story that could exist in a world like that. And the theme of Lackawanna is something that I was really dealing with at that time in my life, because I was going to go on the sailing trip with a good buddy of mine and we're going to sail around the world for a few years. And I knew that if I'd left my dream and my life and everything I had going for me, all this momentum with my filmmaking and everything for like 3 or 4 years, it might not be there when I come back. And so I had to make this decision of like, do I really want to like go into the wild vibes and just live off the map for 4 years on a sailboat? Or do I want to keep living this life that I've been building for myself and hope that it'd like pay off in the future? And so that interface was really interesting to me. And so the way I describe Lackawanna is it's sort of like a thought experiment to the viewer of, can we rewrite our own rules of modern existence, or does society operate its way for a reason? And I think without any spoilers, like, I think in my personal life, at least, I think there's a way to do both. I think you can like kind of have one foot in each world, like be more adventurous, but stay grounded and like do crazy things like us filmmakers do, like spend all of our money on art projects and stuff, while also still like raising a family.
Well, I want to ask you about that as well. So we'll get to that when we get to production. So is it like a very finely written script, or was it more of a treatment and you can kind of organically use the actors to improv and sort of make up the dialogue as it goes, or what was the writing like as far as that goes?
Fortunately, when you fund your own movie, there's no overlords telling you that your script isn't good enough or like you can't do, like I had never written a script before. And when I approached the producer that I wanted to use on this film, my wife produced it. And then one of my good friends, Nathan Kincaid, was a producer as well. And when we approached Nathan, he said, "All right, genius. Well, if you want to make a movie, you need to write a script." And I was like, "I guess that makes sense." And so I Googled how to write a script. And so I'd essentially, like just through osmosis and absorbing all of the films I'd watched my entire life, I got essentially what a movie was, and I got what could be like kind of a roll your eyes type of banal type of movie or like a predictable movie. And then there's something that's a little more interesting to me, like the movies I loved. And so I tried to just kind of write a script based loosely on what I wanted to do. And I think that naivety was kind of good, and the fact that we just felt so confident and like we could go out, yeah, let's shoot all this, it's gonna be awesome. But what I didn't realize was my lack of preparation story-wise in the script really gave me a lot of problems in post, because when I wrote the script, there's literally times where it'd say like montage, like three lines, and it just say like montage, like figure it out, right, sort of stuff. And then we'd film all this stuff. And then in the actual beats of the movie, I'm like, oh my God, I actually needed to do this and this and this. And post took forever. I mean, it took the first rough assembly of Lotawana was 4 hours long. And then I got it cut down to 2 hours. And then we cut another 30 minutes out. And so now the version that's coming out is around 90 minutes. But there was a lot of inexperience on my part that I learned. I'm a commercial guy for a living, and I've done like shorter wakeboard videos and stuff and skateboarding and stuff. But to pace out a narrative for an hour and a half is really hard. Like that's something I'd never done before. And I'm just like, that storytelling for that amount of time, like that was the biggest lesson I learned. And then also make sure your script is buttoned up ahead of time to make sure you know exactly what you're trying to say every moment. So there's not any sort of this like back end, like, oh shit, did I get that? Like, I didn't need to shoot all four of these scenes. Like, they're just right, like filler. No one gives a shit about all that filler stuff. Right. Really, you just need that one little moment right here. But yeah, it was just kind of a make it up as we went sort of thing. And I've written three scripts since then. And I feel like I'm finally starting to figure out, like, okay, being a writer is like the hardest part of the whole thing. Like, sure, whether writing, directing, shooting, like, for me, it's the most difficult, but also the most fun. And I just had to learn that art, I guess. And I've been doing that for the last 5 or 6 years.
What were the movies that inspired you to write this? Because I haven't seen the movie yet. I'm really excited to see it. But I did watch the trailer, and I definitely got sort of David Gordon Green, early David Gordon Green vibes with like All the Real Girls or George Washington. I'm wondering who were the filmmakers specifically for this movie, and what were the movies that were sort of inspiring you to make this?
I do love that George Washington movie. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I had never made a correlation to that movie. I actually saw that movie after I made Lotawana, but yeah, I like that connection there. But my main hero for this movie was Terrence Malick in Tree of Life and all his filmographies. Just like, man, at that point in my life too, I was just like worshiping at his altar. And so I guess Lotawana is, you could either call it a love letter or a straight ripoff.
Right. Now, whatever you want to call it. Same thing. Yeah.
Yep. Definitely inspired by him entirely.
So you have this love letter to Terrence Malick, amazing script, ready to go. Is that when you took a loan out on your house, or what was the next steps as far as, okay, I need a budget here and I need a cast?
Yeah, for sure. So, we got with Nathan and we started meeting with some, financiers and some, people that could loan us some money or produce it, executive produce it. And, what we found was, since I'm in relatively pretty much an unknown filmmaker, nobody knows me, and that was my first feature film, people didn't even know if I could do it. The only way that they wanted to loan us money was if there was a safe bet. And so they told us that, yeah, we can give you this amount of money, but you're going to need a name actor and you need to like make sure that the creative and the ending fits in line with something that's going to be this sort of like bottom red box shelf pre-packaged type of creative movie. And we just knew that wasn't going to work because I wanted to shoot the movie in all the seasons. And so our production lasted for the better part of a year. We didn't shoot the whole time. We had a big hiatus, but like we wouldn't be able to do that with the name actor. And I didn't want to sacrifice the creative because otherwise, why the hell am I doing this in the first place? Like, this is my dream. I'm not going to like make Air Bud 6 or something like that. Like, and so we made the tough choice to just do it ourselves. And then we talked to a banker, actually, a good buddy of Nathan's named Steve Kelly out of Springfield. And he said that, well, if you don't need that much money, why would you go get a loan from somebody anyway? Because then you're kind of beholden to these people and they can do whatever they want with your project. They can force dates. They can do whatever, essentially have you by the balls. And then he says, what you could do is you could just take a loan out on the equity of your house for the bit that you need. And then just you own everything. You can do whatever you want with it. And then you just pay yourself back as you can. And I was like, oh, wow, that actually kind of makes sense. And like from a financial standpoint, you like from the filmmaking community, you always hear never to do that. But when I talked to a banker, he made it make sense in a really interesting way. And then over the next few years, once we wrapped production, we were just really diligent about paying that loan off. And I'm not gonna lie, when I was in full swing of production of Lotawana, I like kind of put the commercial work on hold because this was like a priority in my life. And then when we wrapped Lotawana, I was standing there and I was looking around. I was like, would be sure be nice if I had some commercials right now to work on, get this money coming back in. And my wife and I had a really tough patch financially right after the movie before the commercial work started picking up again. And that is, in hindsight, I wish I would have prepared for that better. But that's how we got the movie financed.
I remember even when our first son was born, I took some time off and the work just disappeared. People forget you exist and you have to
Yeah,
remind
overnight.
everybody. No, I'm here. I'm still ready to work.
Yep, absolutely. That's what happened to us.
Can you say what the budget was, the total budget was? Are you comfortable telling us?
We actually haven't told that, we haven't said publicly anywhere yet. We probably will at some point, but it is. I took a loan out on my house, so you can imagine it is micro budget.
Was the entire budget the loan, or did you find other private sources of financing?
We had some money saved up, and then we got a loan to pay for the rest of production. And then we've just been like all the post stuff and like releasing it online and all the like insurance and all that shit. We've just been paying out of our pocket so that we've financed the entire thing top to bottom. And luckily, we worked with a bunch of friends of ours that worked, a couple of them worked for free or next to nothing. And just because it was a labor of love thing and it was like the small, tight-knit community, we actually have a, once the movie comes out, we have a whole documentary behind the
Oh,
scenes that sort
awesome.
of follows the entire production of the movie and how we got it made and everything. Because one of our buddies was filming the whole time. And so we put that footage together. But it's called At the Helm, The Making of Lotawana. And so it's like indie filmmaking at its most scrappy. And I'm hoping that'll be fun for people to watch.
Yeah. So was the whole crew basically friends and friends of friends, or did you hire anyone that you were interviewing that you didn't know?
No, everybody was pretty much friends. I wasn't as good of friends with Nathan yet, but this was the project that really brought us together. We hired him and our lead actor is a buddy of mine. His name's Todd, and he wasn't an actor. And he and another one of my friends were essentially who I had in my mind when I wrote the script to play the role. And then I approached Todd and I was like, hey, I wrote this movie. I want you to be the lead. And he said, no. And I was like, oh, well, that sucks. Like, now I got to go find somebody. And like I said, the Kansas City pool isn't that deep. And like everybody that we auditioned was either like great at acting, but didn't have the right look, or had the right look but wasn't great at acting. And it was just really hard to find that magical person. And then I pretty much just called my buddy up and told him he was going to do it whether he wanted to or not. And he kind of begrudgingly decided to. But then he put his whole heart into it and did great. And then when it came to casting the girl, the female lead, we found someone locally through a casting call that we liked. But then we shot all of our winter scenes, like a week long of production, and took our hiatus until summer hit. And in that time, my wife and I were on our honeymoon, and we got this email saying she left the business altogether and moved to Colorado to join some religious thing and all this. And we're just like, what is happening right now? Like, we just lost our lead actress. And so we went back to the we stopped our honeymoon early, went back to the drawing board, and we did another nationwide casting thing. We're reaching out to all the different people. We found this girl out of Chicago. She flew into town, and right up until our month-long production that we had scheduled, Nathan and Corey, my producer, had everything buttoned up to a T. But right up until that first day, her mother came into town and thought that she's a real estate agent, but thought she would be fit to be her entertainment lawyer. And she was kind of like a bully and a bulldog. And what had happened was we gave them a contract for her to be in the movie, and they sent it back signed, but they didn't tell us that they'd slipped in a clause that said that at the end of principal photography, we would need to renegotiate the terms of the contract. And we're like, what? That essentially just makes the contract self-destruct once we have you in the can. And that, like, she could have us by the balls too. Like, that would just, that's the worst thing you could ever do as a filmmaker. And so my producers caught that. They actually read it for some reason, like, all the way through. I'm not sure I would have even done that, and saw that they'd slipped that in. And so we confronted them, and then they wouldn't sign, and they were demanding all this stuff. And we, first day of production, she was supposed to be shooting, but we couldn't get them to not be monsters, I guess. I mean, whatever. And so we had a couple scenes we could shoot with just Todd that first day, and we shot all morning with just Todd. And then at lunchtime, my producers called me, and they're like, hey, we don't have a lead actress. We pulled the plug.
Wow.
And I was like, I love it, guys. Like, I trust you. If that's the call that was needed to be made, that's the call that we made. And so halfway through the first day, after we shot all that winter stuff, we still don't have a lead actress. And that screwed up our entire production. We were scrambling every day from then on out. And so Nathan and I looked at the schedule, and we put all the scenes that was only with the lead actor, moved them to the front. And that bought us a few days where we could keep moving while my wife and some other people were doing more casting calls, trying to find a new girl. And then we shot out Todd, and we kind of reached a standstill and hadn't found our next actress. And we were all laying in the production office, the Mammoth office, and Todd was on his phone on Instagram, and he's like, hey, this girl's kind of cute, what do you think? And we're like, I don't know, she's not an actress, and have her send in an audition. And so she sent it in, and she did awesome, and we all loved her. And she's a Kiwi, she's from New Zealand. And so we worked that into the script, because she couldn't mask her accent, because she wasn't familiar with all that. And so she was at her part-time job getting a message in New York City from Todd, and was like, hey, come out and be in this movie. And she's like, what is happening right now? She quit her job, flew to Missouri, stayed with us, and we shot out the whole movie. And then they fell in love in real time while we're shooting, and are now married.
Oh my God. Wow.
So, yeah. It's like this kind of like, it's just this crazy production story that, like, oh my gosh, for just a bunch of like Missouri hillbilly type filmmaker folks trying to make this up as they go. It was like quite a roller coaster. Got the movie in the can, and I'm really happy with it. And thankfully, Rotten Tomatoes, we've started getting some reviews in from some critics on Rotten Tomatoes, and we're at 100% fresh right now. Amazing. With 11 reviews so far. Amazing. And I'm like, this is unreal. Like, I can't even.
Yeah.
So happy about that.
What was your planned schedule as far as how many days and, you know, before, I guess this was on day one, before you lost your lead actress, what was the schedule supposed to be?
30 days of consecutive shooting. And it was scheduled in a way that we were going to have to take a second hiatus for fall to hit. And because everything got delayed, we were actually butting right up against our fall shooting. And we were trying to shoot summer scenes as the leaves were changing. And so we're pointing the camera in the direction where there's no orange leaves, and it's all green still. And but 30 consecutive days on the water. And we the weather and the character of the lake was a very big part of the movie. And so we kept the production as loose as we could to where, all right, this is kind of a down, sad, quiet thing. We needed to be overcast and the lake to be calm and all this stuff. So whatever. Like, if a gorgeous sunset showed up, we would try to shoot this scene if we could that needed to be that moment. And so we really were kind of dictated by the weather. But Nathan helped set us up schedule wise to be able to be flexible for those situations.
So it was 30 days total shoot, or 30 days and then a hiatus and then more shooting?
I'm sorry. It was 7 days in winter at the beginning of 2015, and then 30 days in summer that kind of bled into fall. Gotcha, so it was sort of this like late August, September, October shoot. It wasn't 30 consecutive. We had little days off here and there, and I went and but it was 30 days of shooting over probably a month and a half for the summer fall shoot.
What was the experience of the shoot like for you? What did you learn during that process that you just had no idea you, other than scrambling to find a lead actress, what did you learn that you just weren't expecting?
It was a lot harder to be the DP, camera operator, and director performance-wise than I thought it would be. Because when you're directing commercials, it's not like you're doing really nuanced things. Right. You're not really trying to dial in a performance. Most of it's kind of schlocky, right, and you're just kind of trying to hit these flagship whatever. And then when I was also shooting the thing, the movie, and I had these very specific things that I wanted to get out of the talent and performance-wise, like I'm holding the camera and I'm watching the light and all of my brain space that's going into make sure I'm nailing the focus, make sure the light's doing what it needs to do, make sure I'm getting the movement right. Right. That's brain space is being taken away from the performance. And I just wish that I had more bandwidth to do both. And I didn't really see that coming. And I couldn't afford a great DP that I'd wanted to shoot with anyway. So I kind of had no choice but to shoot it myself, which I was happy to do because I knew what I wanted. But for my next movie, I would love to be able to actually have a DP and a camera operator to where I can actually focus on performance more, because that was the biggest challenge for me creatively, learning on set in real time.
Just looking at the trailer, it looks like true storytelling, true cinema. I don't see any visual effects, for example, or any kind of things, but I'm curious, are there any visual effects? Are there any sort of, as far as the post-process, things that you're not supposed to see? I think it looks like a very grounded story, but Fincher, for example, you know, he often has a lot of visual effects in his films that you'd never see, such as road extensions and matte paintings and things like that. So I'm curious, was there anything like that in this, or was this truly just, we have the footage, let's edit it and make a great film?
There actually was quite a bit of it. We have what I called an evil mastermind. His name's Matthew Lloyd, and he's incredibly powerful. And he's this supercomputer cinema nerd that can do all that technical stuff. And he was working for me full time at Mammoth when we shot the movie. And so we just kind of looped him into the production of the movie as well. And we did all that stuff. We would take out power lines in any shot that we could. And we would, he did fireflies. We're out in this cornfield at night and he put all these fireflies in that look unreal, how good they look. And then there's this elk that shows up on this deserted road later on in the movie. And he did the elk entirely. We went down to Southern Missouri and went to this elk ranch and got all this footage. And it took a long time to get one that was doing the exact move that I wanted. And then he took that elk that was shot in afternoon light and put it in the middle of this deserted road under a street light in the middle of the night. And he made it look incredible. And so, yeah, we have quite a bit of visual effects, but it's all the stuff that you're talking about, like David Fincher, where you just, it looks like it's just practical,
right,
because it's
right.
Like, why would you, you know, like taking ugly bits of ground out of the shot and just stuff like that.
How long was the post-production process?
5 years.
Okay.
Yeah. It took a long time to get the 4-hour cut assembled. And then we had to get a 2-hour cut assembled. And then we actually had one of my best friends, Ryan Pinkston, made the complete score from scratch. He made all the music for the movie. I think we were like 2 years proper in to get like a 2-hour cut by the time we felt good about it. And then we started shopping it around and everyone said it was too long. And I'm like, yeah, it is too long. And then it took just like a lot of time to be okay with cutting down to 1.5 hours, you know, like the whole kill your darlings thing. Yeah, it's like always so hard for filmmakers, but like that was another big lesson I learned, was how to be like an efficient storyteller with this movie instead of just like, because Terrence Malick is gorgeous. And when I was inexperienced, it felt like he just kind of would meander and do whatever he wanted. But now that I'm a more intelligent filmmaker, I know that even when he's just shining at the sun,
right,
it's still informing the story.
Right.
Like, it's still very specific for a very purposeful part of the storytelling at that time. And that's when I really started appreciating his craft even more, because when the first cut, a lot of Wana, you just be, oh, like, I'm going to film this turtle for a while, right, and we're just going to hang out on this turtle.
Right.
And it's like, nah, you don't really need that. Like, when Terrence Malick does it, it's for a reason. And then that's how I started to, like, focus a lot of Wana and be like, all right, like, this turtle's going to show up at this time for this reason now. Like, that type of thing. And it just took me a long time to get there. And honestly, learning the industry, too, the ins and outs of, like, the back-end distribution and everything.
Yeah.
I just really kind of – and we weren't beholden to anybody, so we could take our time to do it right. And I do feel like this is the best movie of the version that there has been so far. And had we been beholden to a financier, I'm sure we probably would have released a subpar movie in a subpar way.
Right,
and
right.
I'm just happy that we just, like, stuck to our guns. We took our time, and yeah, it's finally coming out into the world.
What were the storytelling hurdles that you had to face during post? You mentioned earlier having scenes written as montage and then not necessarily knowing, oh, you need to hit these 5 points in the story.
So there's probably like 5 montages throughout the movie. But they're not like a classic montage, like a suiting up, armor, cocking the, like, we're montaging for this. It's almost like they're like little bits of scenes that kind of drift in and out of music where there's talking and there's like, but they all kind of have to, like, encapsulate a moment in time and get some story beats across. And I would just go out and I would just shoot a bunch of shit and I'd have to try to figure out how to make it all work. And then the, like, this is a bit of a spoiler, but there's this montage at the end of the movie that's like probably the most important part of the whole movie, and in the script it's just like a few lines. It's like, final montage, blah blah blah, figure it out. And I'm just like, why the hell would I think that's okay,
right,
to write,
right,
in a script? Like, I'm just like kicking the can down the road. And then sure enough, when it came down to, like, creating these montages in post, it was just like hell on earth.
Yeah.
I was just like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. I wish I would have, like, plan for this more, kind of known more what I was doing.
Yeah.
which is how I write now. I make sure that when I'm finishing a script, everything is buttoned up.
Yeah. Did you already have the footage when you were trying to figure that stuff out, or did you have to go back out and reshoot things?
We were lucky enough that we shot so damn much, we had way too much footage.
So you just had to find it.
Exactly. And I'm one of those guys that always keeps the camera rolling, and I always shoot in 60 frames per second because, like, the little moments in between moments are, can be like beautiful little breaths,
right,
that you can slow down and use in other places and stuff, and like really construct performances and feelings. And so I just like capture, and then combing through all that stuff. And then there's a couple of moments where I actually mine clips from old footage that I had shot as well.
Oh, nice.
And I know Terrence Malick did that for Tree of Life, and yeah. Kind of creep some of that old stuff in there.
All right, so you spend 5 years editing this thing. It's finally done. And you say, now what?
So what had happened was we were fortunate enough to get conversations with a lot of top-tier distributors. Just because I think of the way that the movie looked, that I guess they could see some quality there. They wanted to have a conversation. But every single one of the ones that we actually got on the horn said that it looks gorgeous. We love what you're doing. You're not famous. Your actors aren't famous. We have no idea how to sell an indie drama like this. Let us know what you're doing next.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Click. And so, okay, that's a little bit of a bummer. We had to learn kind of the business side of the industry at that point, which all came as a surprise after we'd actually made the movie. And then we talked to a lot of low-tier distributors as well that were like, yeah, we want your movie, blah, blah, blah. But we kind of adopted the term spray and pray distributor, which is like kind of the low-key ones where they just like gobble up all the movies they can and then throw them all at the wall and see which ones stick. And we didn't, like, we know we didn't have the best movie in the world, but we know we didn't have the worst movie in the world either. So we didn't really want to settle for those, but we weren't getting into the distributors that we wanted to get into. So we were kind of stuck in this weird middle ground. And that was like right at the time that this whole NFT thing blew up. And then one of my best friends, Tucker, who also worked on the movie, and now he's my brother-in-law, he said, I never even heard of an NFT, and he just like reached out and was like, hey, you should do this NFT stuff with the movie. And so I looked it up and like learned what the blockchain was and learned all this stuff in real time. We found ourselves sitting with the finished movie. The NFT space was just starting to explode.
We're like, wow. Did you consider festivals?
Yeah, and we didn't get into anything.
So you submitted to a bunch.
Yeah, we submitted to most of the top tier and like kind of the middle tier festivals, but we didn't get anything. We didn't do a lot of low tier ones, but we didn't get into anything.
Those festivals are pretty political in their selection process. There's not as many spots open for films that are coming from true indies coming from nowhere as you would think there are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we learned that firsthand, and we'd get denied from festivals, and then we'd watch some of the films that got into festivals. We're like, our movie's way better than that movie. And so we just know it's a business, and so it's not a personal thing, you know. It's like, oh well, this person's the buddy of this, and we're checking this box for this social thing right here, you know. So there's like all these elements that go into it. It's not a big thing. We didn't really take it super personally, but we had this finished film and the NFT thing blew up, and so we're like, well, we could just experiment with this space. Like, the whole movie's kind of an experiment anyway. We own the movie outright. Let's just try it and see what happens. And so we kind of scrambled and made all these NFTs, and we started selling actual ownership to the movie as an NFT, and then we started selling world premiere tickets as well. And then we did a limited run of movie frames as well, like 10 different movie frames from the movie. And it was going great. We sold, I think, like 13, 14 different shares to the movie as an NFT. And then we sold a lot of world premiere tickets. And then we sold out of all the movie frames. And then somebody told us, oh, we were talking to an NFT. Oh, what's the name of the company? I can't even remember the name of the company, but they're like one of the platforms that really sort of amplifies artists and gets these big campaigns going. And we were talking to them. We talked to a lot of people actually in a very short amount of time, because this thing kind of blew up. Screen Rant ran our story, and then IndieWire contacted us, and Movie Maker contacted us, and like, it was awesome. And so we got all this like free publicity for it, and like people were like hearing my name for the first time, and like seeing Lotawana organically through this NFT thing. And then this company, this NFT company, ended up not wanting to work with us because what we were doing was technically illegal, which we didn't know. And you cannot sell through the SEC, which I'd never even heard of. That's a government thing, apparently. But the SEC deems it illegal to sell ownership of a company to somebody that you cannot properly vet. And the reason that exists is because I guess there's certain areas of the world that we don't do business with. I don't know the countries, maybe Saudi Arabia, maybe something. But if you can't guarantee that these people aren't coming from these off-limit countries, then you can't sell it. And we were. I mean, anyone with a blind screen name can buy anything as an NFT.
Right.
And so we were selling securities, which is illegal. And so we talked to our lawyers, and they're like, yeah, you got to stop doing it. Yeah. And so it was kind of a bummer, but it was also right at the time where like our sales had kind of started slowing down a little, like we'd peaked. And so we're like, well, if nothing else, we got like all this awesome free publicity. We like even made a little bit of money. And so we contacted all of our copyright people, and we're like, hey, just want to let you know, like, we're super excited. Thank you for supporting the movie. But what we were doing was actually illegal, and we want to let you know. And we were here to like tell you the truth about our financial returns of what we expect for the movie. And so we gave every one of the copyright shareholders the option to be refunded or stay in, but do it through a more traditional means of investment. And every single one of them offered to just send us back the NFT and be refunded. And I think part of deep down inside a lot of them, they were probably thinking that, phew, like I kind of bought that thing. It wasn't cheap, and I bought it in like the heat of the moment, and maybe it wasn't the best investment. And so every single one of them was super cool, and they sent us the money, or we sent them the money back. They sent us the NFT back. And so we now own the movie in its entirety again. And the world premiere we just did, we hosted this online digital screening for the folks that bought the world premiere NFTs. And yeah, so in the end, it was sort of like we had high hopes that it was going to be like this big thing for us. It ended up being big for us, but it wasn't like the answer to everything. And we had all these high hopes of like, wow, maybe we could like raise money this way. Maybe we could like fund a new movie this way. And we learned that the blockchain is just essentially a new type of internet. Like everybody, and this is an analogy, but like everybody on the internet is trying to be out there, become famous, become something. And it's very rare that you get the grassroots people that really elevate to a place of like true fame or true success through something like that. More often than not, people just get lost in the clutter, and people that already have followings that enter these spaces are the ones that really take off. Like if Grimes or Elon Musk or whoever is like jumps into this NFT space and they already have a huge following, of course their stuff's going to do well. But for someone like me who has no following, I didn't even know what the blockchain was. We're trying to just like stick our hand up in the clutter and be like, hey, look at us. And so we didn't get as much attention as like, say, someone famous would have. Like, say, if Steven Spielberg was doing it, then it's obvious that would have gone a little different. And then also this was our first time dealing with blockchain and crypto and all that. And like the volatility of like the coins and things, we were like, oh my God, this would be terrifying if we actually raised a decent amount of money to fund a movie. And it was just like going up and down, like we actually need a number to work with to make a movie. And so like that volatility was a little scary as well. So like our whole takeaway from the NFT experience is that it's definitely an awesome place for the future, but I don't think there's an infrastructure right now for people like me. I don't think we're there yet. I do think the blockchain's here to stay. I do think all that stuff is going to have a major hand in everything moving forward. But right now, there's just no support system. And there's no, it's like, you know, it's the Wild West. Yeah, it's like, like, I don't want to put all my eggs into that basket and like maybe raise a bunch of money. And then like we go to shoot and then all of a sudden like Ethereum drops or something. Right. And you're just like, well, this is like, now we can't shoot our movie. Like, and the fact that I didn't have any sort of like momentum with my name or anything, like, yeah. Anyway, it's kind of a mixed emotion thing. Like, we're really happy we did it, and I would say it's a net positive experience, but it wasn't everything. At least everything didn't work out for us as well as we had hoped.
Just to reinforce this cautionary tale a little bit, can you talk about what you were before you found out you were doing something that you weren't supposed to be doing? What were you selling? You were selling shares of the movie at what cost, and what exactly did that get them?
We were selling shares of the movie. If somebody were to buy one NFT, we minted 1,000 NFTs, and each NFT was good for 1/1000th of the movie.
Okay.
So if all of them got sold, it would be the whole movie. And we listed them each for $1,000, I think. Yeah. $1,000. Yeah. So it was kind of an expensive buy-in. Like $1,000 only bought you 1/1000th of a movie. But the NFT itself is what has value as well. And that's what a lot of people didn't really understand. And that's why one of the reasons why we don't think we had a huge organic movement is because Hollywood, like our articles, were the first time people were even hearing about it in Hollywood. Right. Like no one even knew what it was. They're just like, okay, whatever. Like we've gotten some attention like after the fact, but like had Hollywood known what this was, we think maybe more had happened with it, but we think we're just way ahead of the curve because like the NFT people aren't filmmakers. They didn't really like, not many of them even showed up to the world premiere. The digital world premiere we hosted, they're more in it for like the crypto investing NFT side of things. Right. And then filmmakers in Hollywood didn't give a shit about any.
They don't understand it. They still don't understand it.
Exactly. And so it's like, it's just this weird place to be in. Like we're behind the curve on some of it, but we're ahead of the curve on the other of it. And it's not all matching up. And it's just like, who knows what's going to happen with it.
Right. Was the NFT itself like a JPEG or a picture or a contract, or what was the NFT?
It was a contract, and then it came also with a HD and 4K resolution copy of the movie. It came with a poster signed by me and digitally scanned on, and then like a trailer, and just like they got all the digital assets with it as well. So it wasn't just like a nothing thing, but they actually got an ownership of the movie and then the digital stuff as well, like the copy of the movie and everything.
So buying this NFT is equal to them signing a contract saying, here's $1,000 for a thousandth share of the film.
Exactly. And we had a lot of the terms listed out on the NFT page itself. So if somebody clicked purchase, that just automatically was like the smart contract in the blockchain would just have all of that metadata with it and know that that's what we were signing. That was kind of unnerving to us as well, because like we'd put the terms and stuff in it, but then that's locked into stone. Once you start selling these things, like there's a couple things we needed to adjust slightly, nothing big, but we were just like, oh, we should have probably worded it that way. You can't go back. Like it's locked in stone forever. And anybody, like, say if you forget to say something really important in your description,
right,
and someone's like, oh, technically I could own the whole thing, right, you know, like whatever that would be, you can't fix that. Like once you start selling that, it was locked into stone on the blockchain.
Did you have a lawyer write that description, or was it just you and your producers?
It was just us and our producers. We kind of took lingo from other things we saw similar online, and we got it pretty dang close. We're not sketched out by anything we did, but there was just little things here and there that like, oh, we should have put like an end date on that instead of like, you know, like that type of stuff. We got the big things right, thankfully.
I know there are other films doing similar things. So if you were to do something like this tomorrow, what is the legal version?
It's still illegal. It will never be legal until the company we talked to that is in the NFT space that creates those platforms, they say there's a lot of folks right now that are trying to change it. So maybe the rules could change tomorrow. It's sort of this, like, I don't know, a lot of people don't think it's fair or right that this is an actual law. And so there's people fighting it, but who knows if it's going to change. But if you try to go do this tomorrow, you're going to run into the same thing. You're going to be doing something that's technically illegal, and the SEC is not going to like you.
Do you know what the version of this would be with that you're not worried about the SEC? In other words, it would be you're selling JPEGs that it's just an investment and you don't get anything, or you get, mm-hmm. or what? What would that version be?
As long as you're not selling ownership of a company, you can make money off of your NFT. Like if you buy and sell and make money off of your NFT, but if you're buying ownership of an independent company that will give you profits in return, you can't do that unless you can vet the people. So we didn't have to return our world premiere tickets, and those people still own those NFTs. If somebody down the road decides they wanted to buy one of those NFTs from one of those NFT holders, obviously they wouldn't get to go to the premiere in real time,
right,
but they would get all those assets and they would still get to own the NFT. But that wasn't selling something that's partaking in profits. Like, you know, like when Lotawana were and is being distributed, we were going to divvy up all of the profits to all of the shareholders that bought those NFTs. And that's the illegal part.
Where did you find those shareholders to begin with? Were they complete strangers, or were you marketing the film to, hey, buy this NFT, you can be a shareholder? Or were they friends that were shareholders?
I think one or two people came from like our extended circle. But for the most part, I think like 13 or 14 of the people that bought shares all found us organically through, I mean, we did some interviews and some podcasts and some press in the NFT space as well, just from people coming at us. And we were very thankful for those opportunities. But since they were $1,000 a piece, they weren't that cheap that like no one in the movie world really cared about investing in anything like that. And so, yeah, I think it was just all organic. We didn't do any real advertisement. We just were lucky enough to get that Screen Rant article, which was kind of the start to all of the rest of the pub.
Right. Is this space still something that you're excited about and interested in doing more in? Or did this experience turn you off and you're just done with it?
Oh, I think there's a future for it. I think right now there's no structure though. And right now there's no clear path. It's the Wild West. Like, it's a gold rush. Like, who knows what's going to happen with it? It's exciting. Some people are going to freaking hit gold. Most people aren't. And put a lot of time and money into something that's not going to pay off. But for those who do it right and can navigate this space, well, sure, the sky's the limit. But for me personally, like, I'm sort of a hopeless romantic, creative, emotional type that I hate business and money and all of, like, even just normal running a company and all that stuff and contracts. Like, that stuff just hurts my soul so much that, like, I actually stopped running a company full time, and now I chose to be repped as a director DP instead of running my own company, and my life is just so much better not running all that stuff. So I just natively as a person do not like things like the blockchain and crypto and money and exchanges and all that. Like, it just, it's not what I'm into. God bless the people that are, because they keep people like me going, but that's just not what feeds my soul.
Sure.
And so I don't have any desire to do anything in the blockchain again for that reason, but I also don't have any desire to, like, run a company or invest in the stock market or any of that other shit that people do regularly, just because, like, I've come to terms with the fact that I would rather die a poor man and, like, chase my artistic dreams than, like, try to become, like, spend all of my time chasing that stuff that I'm just not that into. And there's nothing wrong with being into it. It's just different things work for different. There's a butt for every seat. You know what I mean? It's just not my dream. Like, I want to make movies, and I'm, like, really emotional and obsessed with, like, creating the art of it. And when I get distracted from that, it feels like, oh, why am I having to deal with this freaking client over here? Like, I just want to be like a, you know, like, I'm one of those fussy creative types.
So going back to traditional distribution, where did it land? How are you distributing it?
We were not able to sign with one of the top tier folks that we wanted. And I'll go ahead and say this out loud. I haven't really said this much, but, like, we were really hoping for, like, an A24 or a Neon one of those, like, you know, like every filmmaker hoping for, but we couldn't even get A24 on the line. So who knows if they would have been into us or not, but, like, A24, like I said, we know Lotta One is not the best movie in the world, but there's some low tier movies on A24's roster that I'm like, I know Lotta One is better than that movie. Like, and so we didn't, and we chose not to sign with those underbelly of, like, spray and pray distributors. So we were stuck in this middle ground, and we were working with this one distributor who was going to take us on, and they're kind of like this mid-level, but they had all these, like, really high, like, they would take lots of cuts, and they weren't going to put a bunch of money into advertisement. And I was like, well, that's kind of like the main reason why you'd want to go with the distributor, is because they have all their fingers into the industry and can really pump it out there. And I'm like, why would we sign with these folks if they aren't going to pump the movie? So what we did was we just went with an aggregator that essentially does the exact same thing that distributor was going to do. And so we paid the upfront fee of just putting our movie on iTunes, Amazon, Google, and Vudu/Fandango. And then we paid an upfront fee and then keep all of our profits instead of splitting all of our profits with this distributor that wasn't going to pump the movie. And yeah, now the advertising still falls on us, and we're hoping that there's going to be some sort of, like, organic niche market that's going to find this movie, because I think it speaks to the, like, outdoorsy type of crowd and, like, the alternative lifestyle type of folks. And we're hoping that there'll be some, like, life breathed into the movie just as it starts to trickle out into the world. But yeah, advertising's all on us. We got to start really figuring out how to do that and pump it and get it going. But yeah, we're kind of just charting a course right now. We don't really know what's going to happen at all.
What are your thoughts on advertising and publicity? Do you have a target list of people you're trying to reach, or publications or interviews, or are you leaning more on the organic people finding your film?
Honestly, like, even talking to you right now is just a huge, like, opportunity for us, because it's just stuff like this that I think, like, we're never going to have the money. Just my wife and I are never going to have the money to just do, like, a grassroots advertising push to, like a studio would, and just, like, market across the whole nation and all this stuff. Like, we're really just going to rely on the fact that, like, the cream rises at the top, and we're going to, like, be smart and put our tentacles out where we can and like let our network kind of grow it. And like if it's a good product, it'll get spread. It'll take some time for sure. It'll take a long time, but you never know, like the right person comes along. Maybe they'll catch it and want to pump it. And I don't know. Advertising is one of those things that I'm going to start complaining about here really quickly. Sure. Because I hate it so much.
Sure. Yeah, I get it. I mean, the fun part is over and now you have to get it out there and get people to see it. I think it's helpful to hear, you know, what the other tentacles are that, like, you know, maybe we should reach out to this person or maybe we should look into getting this kind of publicity.
I wish I had an answer for that. Like, that's what I want to know.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the holy grail of like, if there was a secret way to like get the movie out, what is that? And like, I'm essentially just talking to you sitting on my bed right now, like any other normal dude, like, right, I don't know, like, how the hell do you put a movie out into the world? Like, we're going to like pump it on our social media and like maybe try to email some critics and stuff and see if they won't review it. I mean, that's kind of where we're at, though.
How did you get the reviews that you said are on Rotten Tomatoes?
So there's actually a company out there that will just forward your movie along. They have all the critics on Rotten Tomatoes and you just pay a fee and they'll put it out and whoever wants to review it can. And they probably get a little bit of kickback, but it's all totally honest reviews. Like when we reached out to the company, they were extremely nice and they were just like, yeah, we'll put it out in front of people. And so you pay them a little bit of a fee and then some reviewers will pick it up. And like, I don't know how much their kickback can't be that much money because it's really not that much money to do this.
Right,
so
right.
They're real and honest reviews. And yeah, we've been like flabbergasted, like just blown away by the reviews so far. Like, honestly, I've been telling my wife and my team this, that like, had we started getting reviews in and they were all rotten, I probably wouldn't even be advertising the movie. I'd probably just like throw it up on the platform and just be embarrassed
and say,
by it. And be
like, Alan Smithy. Yeah. It's not me. Right.
Yeah. Just whatever. Like that was my film school. Whatever. But now that the fact that like reviews are coming in and they're positive and like some of them have said some pretty incredible
things. Now you're
things.
Like, I had no crew. I did everything by myself and I'm the star and there was no one else here.
Yeah. I did everything. No, but it's like, it's honestly given me like wind in my sails. It's given me the confidence to put the movie out into the world. Cause you know, like if you're the filmmaker, you're so self-conscious about everything. And like, I'll look at the shots and be like, oh my gosh, I would have done this so differently now that I'm 5 years more experienced. And like, it's just, you know, like I hate it for a lot of it. And only now that I'm feeling like it's being received well by some people, that I can start to look at it with more rose-colored glasses and be like, oh, okay, yeah, it works. Like,
right.
Get it. Yeah, it's not that bad.
So I know this is a trick question that you can only answer one way, but what was it like working with your wife as a producer?
Oh, it was actually awesome. Like, no bullshit. Funny story, she's not a filmmaker. She's an extremely talented musician. She yodels and has got an album coming out and all this stuff. But back when
What's her name so people can look her up?
Corey Jo Hawkins. Ryan Pinkston, who made all the music for Lotawana, is producing her album. And she's like this new age folk singer and does yodeling and all this kind of incredible stuff. But she's the most talented one of the whole freaking production. And she's not even a filmmaker. But she went back when we were courting producers, she came to be in the picture. And this is kind of a funny story. She might kill me for saying this. But I'd just taken meetings with people. And one of the producers that I met with happened to be a younger girl. And she got a little jealous. And she was like, why is she going to be your producer? I could be your producer. And so she did. And she jumped in and she killed it. She did so good. And then we brought in Nathan, who is a filmmaker and has a bit more experience with like kind of laying the production out. But at the end of the day, like we navigated that experience really well. And it's something that we get to share forever in our relationship now. Like filmmakers know what it's like to go to war and go to battle with this like arm in arm with this small core group of people. And I'm really happy that my wife got to do that with me and that I got to do that with her, because now we understand what that is and we've grown closer because of it.
That's the correct answer. She's going to send me a check later for that answer. When did the baby come into the picture? At what point in the filmmaking process with Lotawana did the baby come?
Luckily, he came way later, fortunately, financially and creatively and emotionally as well. He's only a year old, so I think I was making the last changes to the last little small, like the last little whittling away of the movie when he was young. But yeah, he's kind of after the fact for the most part. So he hasn't been a big deal, And my wife is so incredible. We have this kind of schedule worked out where if I wake up real early in the mornings, then she'll take him and I will get to spend my time writing, because any writer knows that it's just so damn time intensive.
Yeah.
And like, that's the hardest part with kids, is just finding the time. And I've heard that Paul Thomas Anderson, he wakes up at like 4 a.m. so he can get writing done.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the life I'm living right now.
What are you working on next, as far as you're writing a new movie now, you said?
Yep. So I've actually got, I've written 3 scripts since La Tawana, one of them being the movie that I really, really have always wanted to make, but it's just, it's going to be expensive. And so I've got a third movie written, which is like in just a fun exercise. It's like a big epic 3-hour thing that I just felt like writing for the practice of it. And then the fourth script I wrote is called Lunker. And that's the movie that I'm going to try to make as my sophomore film. It was purposely written to be like a low bud, not a micro budget indie startup thing, but like a low budget, properly funded type of film. It's a dark comedy horror film set within the competitive largemouth bass fishing culture of the 1970s.
I love it. I'm in.
That's what I'm hoping to get made next.
And what are you doing differently this time? Do you plan on independently producing that as well? Or are you reaching out to financiers, or what's your plan with that?
Oh my gosh. Any of it, all of the above. Yeah. I'm still like buttoning up the script right now. I'm on my 6th rewrite, and La Tawana is just now getting into the world. So I'm like trying to simultaneously launch La Tawana while making sure my next project is ready to go. And so I haven't really gotten to the step where I'm like really kind of put it out into the world to see what attention I can get. I'm hoping La Tawana is going to bring a little bit of that organically, and like maybe someone will find some interest, but I have no idea, honestly.
Give us the pitch for La Tawana. What is it and how can people watch it?
So it's a film about a young couple that are sort of over the materialistic lives, sort of the 9-to-5 that they've been living, and they recreate this world for themselves out on a sailboat on a small lake in Missouri. And maybe because of a bit of their lack of preparedness and their idealism, like the real world kind of comes crashing down on the world that they've built. And like I said earlier, the whole thing sort of exists as this thought experiment to the viewer of, can we rewrite our own rules of modern existence, or does society operate its way for a reason? And I think that's one of the reasons why we've gotten a lot of good reviews so far, is I think we really try to navigate those waters delicately and create it in a way that no matter where people are at their lives, they can inject themselves into it. And yeah, I'm stoked about it.
And when does it come out?
February 3rd.
For more on Trevor, check out trevorhawkinsfilm.com, latawanamovie.com. Both those links will be in the episode description. And thank you very much, Trevor, for coming on the show. It was really fun talking and hearing your journey through all this.
Matt, I mean, the pleasure was all mine, dude. For real. Like, I'm a nobody filmmaker. And just folks like you reaching out to me, giving me opportunities to even talk in front of an audience is like, it is awesome for me. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.